All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable William S. Greenberg presiding. All who have business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good afternoon. This is the appeal of Cameron as it relates to the case of Veterans Representative Bolden versus the Secretary. With me are my colleagues, Judges Allen and Toth. Counsel will please enter their appearances. Who will argue? Secretary? You'll argue? Thanks very much. Want to reserve any time?
10 minutes.
Thank you. Proceed.
May it please the court, Kenneth Carpenter on behalf of Mr. John Cameron. I could begin with a brief overview of the legislative history of 5904. Prior to the enactment.
Well, wait a minute. Is legislative history necessary?
I believe.
Why isn't the language plain on its face? And we as a court will do the statutory construction if that's what you want us to do.
That is precisely what I want you to do.
Yeah, but as I think it was Justice Scalia in Conroy against Aniskoff, what do we need legislative history if the meaning, if the language is plain and unmistakable?
I may not have been clear. I was merely wanting to describe the different versions of the statute as they existed, because I believe that it is relevant to an understanding of the plain language of the statute as it existed at the time at issue in this case.
Go ahead.
Prior to the enactment of the Veterans Judicial Review Act, Congress imposed a $10 fee cap, meaning that fees could not be charged in excess of $10. With the enactment of the VJRA, the period from November 1988 to June 20, 2007, Congress prohibited fees being charged for services provided before the first final decision of the board and required the retention of the attorney within 1 year. That provision of the law ended on June 20, 2007. Beginning June 20, 2007 through February 19, 2019, Congress prohibited the charging of fees by agents or attorneys for services provided before a notice of disagreement. After February of 2019, it is for services provided before an initial decision of the agency of original jurisdiction.
Mr. Carpenter, could I ask you a couple questions
set
this? I'm tempted to ask you about our deference just to confuse you from a few hours ago, but I'll leave that alone. So first of all, has Mr. Cameron or you as Mr. Cameron's counsel here had any communication with the veteran?
Mr. Bolden?
Yes, about whether or not we know anything about his position on this matter. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, right, because if Mr. Cameron wins, Mr. Bolden loses. I understand that's a much more complicated way to say, but I mean, what I mean is if he prevails, then literally Mr. Bolden loses in the sense that money that would go to him will go to Mr. Cameron, right?
I do not believe that's a foregone conclusion or that is legally correct. That
you mean with great respect, you don't believe that?
Yes, Your Honor.
You're addressing the court.
Excuse me. With respect, Your Honor, I do not believe that that is a correct statement, that there is a consequence to the veteran. The Secretary has, in the past, gone back and attempted to recover those fees.
Yes, I've been on some of those cases. But so and you are absolutely right that we can't look into the future and know for certain what's going to happen, right? So, but we can agree on this. If Mr. Cameron doesn't appeal in this, prevail in this appeal, there's no question that Mr. Bolden's recovery can go down, right? Because there's nobody could ever take anything from it, right?
Right, Your Honor, but I'm sorry. Maybe I didn't hear your original question correctly or didn't respond to it correctly. As I understand it, no fees have been dispersed. So the 20% fees are still retained by the secretary. So there's been no distribution to Mr. Bolden that would raise that overpayment issue.
Right, and my questions may seem like I'm taking this down a road we don't need to. My only point is Mr. Bolden still has a dog in this race.
Yes.
And right, and he might be totally on the side of Mr. Cameron. He might be totally unaware that this is even going on, or he might, like Mr. Sheely, be antagonistic to the veteran or to the council, right? But it strikes me that he does still have the dog in the race, so to speak, right?
He does, Your Honor. And it's my understanding, I have not spoken to Mr. Bolden directly, but it is my understanding from Mr. Cameron that Mr. Bolden believes that he is obligated under the fee agreement that he entered into in 2010 to pay the fees to Mr. Cameron. And he has not entered his appearance in this proceeding to assert any other position.
Okay, and second, what right in particular, as particular as you can make it, is Mr. Cameron asserting here?
The right that he is asserting is the right to charge and receive the fee under the fee agreement that he entered into in 2010 with Mr. Bolden to receive the contingent fee of 20% of the past due benefits awarded under the provisions of 5904D.
And so he's not asserting any right of Mr. Bolden?
No.
Okay. Well, no, because that distinguishes this case from Stanley.
Yeah.
And Chewy, actually. So he's asserting essentially, if I can rephrase it, he is asserting his right that arises under the common law by basis of contract to charge and receive a fee during this period that essentially the statute and regulation stop that common law right from essentially producing income.
That's correct.
Okay.
That the fee agreement that was entered into is valid under the provisions of 5904C1 as they existed at the time in which he entered into that contract, which is the relevance to the sequence of events of the changing of the versions of 5904C1. The timeline in this case, just to go directly to your question, Your Honor, is that Mr. Bolden filed a notice of disagreement in August of 2005. On June 20, 2007, when the new version of the law came into effect, that law reversed, repealed the provisions that existed before, which are a first final board decision and a retention of the attorney or the agent.
Mr. Carpenter, I don't think anybody disagrees with you about the substance of the law, but I mean, I'm curious, in your reply brief, you never really touched upon the secretary's argument that the actual the text of the effective date contains that it shall apply with respect to services of agents and attorneys that are provided with respect to cases in which notices of disagreement are filed on or after that date, right? And so I'm curious as to what do you make of that language, especially the on or after that date?
And I'm sorry, where are you saying that's coming from?
It's in the public law, in the text of as to the effective date, and then the reg adds 180 days, and I think that's where they come up with that January.
I believe that is a mischaracterization of what the statute says. The statute never uses the phrase on or after. The effective date of the statute is the date in which that statute and its rules became effective.
I mean, are you saying that in the public law is not valid law? I mean, the Congress did not write those words?
I'm saying that those words are inconsistent with the words that are written in the statute. The statute...
How are they inconsistent?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor?
How are they inconsistent? You have a substantive change in the law. They move the goalposts back a few yards, shall we say,
yes.
When an attorney can lawfully collect a fee. Are you with me so far?
Yes.
That's the substance.
But it's just as much part of the statute that says the effective date is 180 days from enactment. Enactment under the Constitution is when the president signs it.
I understand that.
So you can't know when the president is going to sign it when Congress passes it. So Congress decided to say its effective date is 180 days from enactment. And so we don't need a regulation to do that calculation.
I understand that.
That's just as much part of the law as a substantive change, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, but when there is a conflict between what is stated or characterized in that portion of the public law.
I mean, you'd be talking about effectively an intra-statutory conflict. What would the conflict be?
The conflict would be the on or after language. There is no on or after language in the text of the statute. The statute creates a prohibition from the charging of fees before a certain act, not on or after. The use of the phrase on or after suggests something completely different than the plain language of the statute.
Yeah, but where does this on or after language appear? The regulation?
It now appears in the regulation.
All right, forget the regulation. Let's assume the secretary didn't need to adopt a regulation, probably shouldn't have. We don't need a regulation to effectuate the act of Congress. It's effective 180 days from enactment. The substantive change we make is effective 180 days after enactment. Isn't that all we need to look at?
Yes, Your Honor, but you...
And so anything that happens before 180 days have elapsed is under the old law.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree.
Why?
Because the plain language of the statute prohibits the charging of a fee before a certain act. It doesn't say that that act is on or after the date, as it says later in the public law.
So let me try to. Okay, so you're essentially approaching this, or all of us now are essentially approaching this, in the sense that we have three legal things there, right? One is the statute Congress enacted that was actually given a USC designation.
Correct.
That's what you're talking about when you use the word before, right? It can't be charged before the date on which the board makes a final decision, or now the NOD, right? That's where you're looking at before.
Correct.
We then have another thing Congress did, which it did only in the public law, did not get codified, but still is law, which is the effective date, which says applies 120 days after an act.
180
days, sorry. Okay, and then we have a third legal source, which is then the regulation, which then talks about the on or after, right?
Correct, but I thought...
Or on or before, right, okay.
Yes, but I thought that Judge Toth said the public law said that. I'm not familiar with that specific language.
Yeah, that's where the effective date, at least
right, it says 180 days, but then the regulation does an actual date, right? The regulation actually uses June 19, 2007, as opposed to saying 180 days.
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm confused between what Judge Toth said, that the on or after language was in the public law. And that's what I was having the colloquy with Judge Greenberg about.
Right. I agree. It's just that I think things were getting a little mixed up, because if we just had the statute that's codified, okay,
yes,
that you're talking about using the before, right, before a certain event, and you then have the regulation, which then talks about being filed, you know, by the date, all right, then you might, I think, have a situation in which the conflict that you're framing actually is present, right? Because it would say, well, the regulation is sort of taking a position on retroactivity when the language of the statute doesn't. It just specifies an event in time, right? I actually think that the provision of the public law Judge Toth was talking about, labeled effective date, may resolve that conflict. In other words, it specifies when the change that the codified portion puts into place is now going to take effect.
Agreed.
Right? At that point in time, isn't it consistent to then read the regulation as simply being an implementation of Congress's direction about when its change in the triggering event to get fees comes into play? In other words, the retroactivity question is off the table, if you will, because of Congress's use of the effective date issue.
If that was what the language of the regulation says, but the regulation is framed in terms of the circumstances under which a fee may be charged, that is contradictory to the plain language of 5904.
No, it isn't. All it is, with all due respect, sir, isn't that an attempt by the Secretary to do the calculation of the 180 days from the enactment?
There's no need to do the calculation.
That's what my point exactly. Somebody has to do the calculation at some point because Congress said 180 days from enactment. Enactment is the signature or the agreement of the president. So no one knew at the time they passed the law when that was going to be.
But the question is, what came into effect?
Nothing came into effect until 180 days after enactment.
On the
100- Isn't that the issue here? You say no. You say the substantive law came into effect sometime before that 180 days.
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor. I don't believe that is my position. My position is that once the 181st day came about.
Yes.
So the statute has now been implemented. It is on the books.
Yes.
That it is the plain language of that statute which controls the prohibition for the charging of fees. The prohibition that is imposed by the statute is you cannot charge a fee before a notice of disagreement. The fees charged here were not for services performed before the notice of disagreement.
Well, what were they for?
They were for the contingent fee that was entered into in August of 2010. The contingent fee in this case makes no reference to the statutory or regulatory language. It simply complies with the language of 5904D. And in the facts of this case, there was a notice of disagreement in August of 2005. Under the language of the regulation, Mr. Cameron is prohibited from charging a fee. Under the plain language of the statute, he is entitled to a fee because the work he performed to prepare, to respond to the SOC and to prepare the substantive appeal were all done after the filing of the notice of disagreement. And therefore, the existing law that was in effect on August 2010, when the fee agreement was entered into, was a prohibition from charging a fee. The statutory language said that he was entitled to a fee for services that were performed after the notice of disagreement. And the notice of disagreement in this case was August of 2005, which is not a bar under the plain language of the statute.
Well, but the effective date part that Congress created itself, though, if it had just said the act takes effect 180 days after enactment, then I think there might be ambiguity, but it goes on to then say that it shall apply with respect to services and agents of agents and attorneys that are provided with respect to cases in which notices of disagreement are filed on or after that date. So it does two things. It says the act itself becomes effective 180 days after, and then it says how we're going to deal with the fact that there will have been notices of disagreement before and after and floating around, and it draws that line in the sand. So I don't
I understand that, Your Honor, and that raises a question of law, in my view, as to whether or not the statutory language is correctly applied.
Mr. Carpenter, are you aware of anywhere where courts have basically just agreed to ignore things in the public law? I mean, in the notes?
No.
What statutory construction, like what canon would allow us just to flat out read out
the
words of the public law?
I don't believe it's reading it out, Your Honor. I think it's a question of recognizing that that language is in conflict with what the statute says. What the statute says is that certain...
what language? Can you speak clear?
The plain text that went into the codified version of the law.
So you're now talking about the fact that the effective date provision that is just in the public law is inconsistent with the codified version of the statute 5904.
That's correct, Your Honor. That the language of that statute is framed in terms of the prohibition of charging of fees or receiving a fee before the filing of a notice of disagreement.
So why wouldn't we, does it live in a world in which that's true for a moment? Why wouldn't we say then, so Congress has said two things which are arguably in conflict with itself. Therefore, the agency has adopted a regulation that picks one of those two ways. Wouldn't that be a permissible construction of the statute under Chevron, even under that approach? Because you will admit that the regulation is consistent with the effective date provision that's in the public law.
Yes.
Okay. So if that's the case, and we'll just stick with the world that the effective date provision is somehow inconsistent with the with the codified statutory provision, both passed by Congress, both signed by the President, if the agency picks one of those two approaches, isn't that permissible?
I believe that your construction of it would be permissible. I'm not sure that it, to determine that it would be permissible, but I'm not sure that it is permissible for the Secretary to have done that in the creation of the regulation, because the regulation conflicts with the clear intent of Congress to apply a prohibition to the charging of a fee.
All right, we'll continue when you reply. Your time's up. Secretary.
Good afternoon, Judge Greenberg, and may it please the court. Accepting that appellant has standing, and if the court does not stay this case pending the resolution of Carpenter Chartered, this court should hold that section 14.636C is valid because it implements the effective date Congress provided when it amended section 5904C. And it should affirm the January 2018 board decision because the board correctly denied attorney fees under the applicable pre-amended version of the statute. It is the unambiguously expressed intent of Congress that the amendments to 5904C would apply to cases in which an NOD is filed after June 19th, 2007. Section 101.
Is that 180 days from enactenant?
Yes, Your Honor. June 20th.
Who did the calculation? Secretary?
I assume the Secretary calculated that date.
And do you know how the Secretary did it? Did the Secretary look at an engrossed copy of the statute as sent by Congress in the ordinary course of business to the White House?
I'm not sure how that date is calculated. I don't think there is a dispute as to the actual date being June 20th.
So there's no dispute as to what 180 days from enactment is?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right, keep going.
So as Judge Toth mentioned, Section 101H of the Veterans Benefits Act of 2006 provides explicitly that the amendments would be effective 180 days after the enactment and apply to cases in which an NOD is filed on or after that date. But that's the law, even though it is a note to Section 5904 in the Act and not in the United States Code. As the Supreme Court noted in U.S. National Bank, a provision that's in the statutes at large is the law.
Could I just ask you to tell me your position, the Secretary's position on standing, just so we can all be on the same page?
Yes, Your Honor. The Secretary agrees that appellant has standing. There was no invocation of a third-party standing issue. In Cameron, this court stated that the amendment applies, the 5904 amendment applies if the NOD is filed after June 19th, 2007. That conclusion is not dicta. It was central to the court's analysis. Cameron involved a dispute over which version of the statute applied in that case. The relevant statute section of Cameron discussed only 5904C, noted its amendment, and stated that it was effective if an NOD is filed after June 19th, 2007. And in doing so, the court cited both the 2006 Act and the regulation.
So what are we doing here? Is this another bite at the apple?
It appears
sought by the same person who argued, or the same statute that was involved in the first Cameron case.
In the Secretary's view, it would be a question that was resolved by the court already in Cameron.
So now we have to say, and we really mean it?
I suppose so. And I do think that the question was resolved in Cameron, and also that the regulation is valid because it implements 5904C by providing the effective date that Congress noted in the 2000s.
Well, why does the Secretary do this? The Secretary seems to do this all the time. You repeat the words of the statute, and then you engraft something extra, which gives rise to an arguable inconsistency. I mean, why not leave it alone? Why did you adopt a regulation that had a specific date in it? Why not leave it to the Congress, said 180 days? So when a veteran comes in or a lawyer comes in and says, I want a fee for this, somebody just adds up to 180 days from enactment and you get your fee or you don't.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I do not know why the regulation has the date rather than 180 days after the enactment.
Good answer. Respectfully, you don't know why. But you agree we don't even have to deal with it if we're talking strictly about a matter of statutory construction. What did Congress intend with the plain language? It's not effective until 180 days from enactment.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. Keep going.
The appellant and the Secretary have no disagreement about when the NOD was filed in this case. It was August 2005. So that is before the effective date of 5904C amendment. So under the applicable pre-amended version of the statute, no fees would be warranted because, as appellant agrees, there was no final board decision.
Could I just get your reaction, just so we have it on the table, too, about appellant's argument about what I'm going to call an intra-statutory conflict? In other words, there are times in the world where Congress says two things that arguably are inconsistent with one another, even in the same statute. That's not a dig on Congress, right? The longer the statute, the more difficulty that can be. What's your position on whether there actually is a conflict between the codified changes in 2006 and the enacted effective date provisions that just weren't given a USC designation?
Your Honor, there is no conflict. The codified version doesn't actually have an effective date. That appears only in Section 101H of the 2006 Act. So the statute and the Act both say that the amendments basically move the goalposts, as Judge Greenberg was saying, to the date the NOD is filed.
I agree with you, but I think I understand, this was my fault, not anybody else's, but I think I understand better sitting here now the argument about being a conflict, which is if all the uncodified effective date provision said was it'll be effective 180 days after enactment, right? Then that would be telling the world when the codified version starts to take effect, and it wouldn't do anything else. There would be no confusion, right? I think what appellant is saying is it's the addition of the language after that in the effective date provision that causes the conflict. In other words, that says, but it will only be effective to notices of disagreement filed 180 days after. And I think what he's saying, and I don't want to put words into Mr. Carpenter's mouth, is That is inconsistent with the codified provision that says once this law is effective, it will deal with any NOD or services before or after, rather. Right? If you see what I mean, there's different than saying this statute now applies. That's just the 180 days, right?
Yes.
Now it's saying, yes, and when it starts, I think his argument is, we are now saying something that's sort of different than the codified provision.
Are
you following me?
Question, Your Honor. So yes, there are two parts to the 2006 Act, which says it will be effective 180 days from the enactment and applied in certain cases. So the second part, I also do not think conflicts with the statute. There's no actual effective date noted in the statute, but Congress provided that in the public law. So that is Congress's intent. That's part of the law. And I don't see how that conflicts with the statute.
And so here's what I would say, right? Like, let's just assume that what happened was just the enacting of the codified provision, okay, that says before the date on which a notice of disagreement is filed, okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And then Congress just enacts that, right? Then the argument would be about, but didn't have this whole effective date provision, right? Then the argument in the world that we would all have would be whether or not that statutory provision takes effect at the moment it goes into effect. Is it retroactive? Does, you know, in other words, we'd have all of that. But I think the appellant's argument is the moment we say the statute applies so that you can get a fee as long as it's not before a notice of disagreement is filed, right? I think his argument would be at that moment in time, because all of the services that I'm charging for now were after a notice of disagreement was filed, that's all I need to know. It doesn't matter when the notice of disagreement was filed. It's about when the services were performed in connection with when it is. And so once the rule is, can't be before a notice of disagreement, once that rule is in place, all you need to know is, were the services performed after a notice of disagreement or not, right? And so I think his argument is, by the effective date provision, adding then that next part that says something about actually when the notice of disagreement had to be filed, that creates an ambiguity in the statute.
Your Honor, I believe I am following your question, but I do not think, even if there is some type of ambiguity, that the regulation, I suppose this is your question, would be manifestly contrary to the statute or arbitrary.
That's what I was going to,
right.
Which is that even if there is that ambiguity, then we just get to the question about whether the regulation is a permissible construction of an ambiguous statute.
And it is a permissible construction because clearly this was Congress's intent, which is what you look to, and whether it's manifestly contrary, because in the Act itself, Congress did provide that second part of the effective date, which is that it applies to cases in which an NOD is filed on or after.
I mean, would you understand that language as basically a non-retroactivity provision?
Yes, Your Honor. For cases pending in which an NOD was filed, the statutory amendments would not be retroactive. And again, Congress can make a statute retroactive if it chooses, but it didn't do so here. The NOD date also is not arbitrary, to further answer your question, because we all agree that the NOD is this new triggering event. So to make it effective for cases in which an NOD has not been filed yet makes sense. And for veterans who had a claim pending, they filed an NOD and they have representation, they're working under the assumption that their attorney could not be paid fees from their past due benefits until and unless the board issued a final decision that it appealed. So it makes sense in that, looking at what the veteran's expectations were, and certainly in this case, when the veteran and the appellant entered a fee agreement in 2004, there was only one version of 5904C, and it prohibited fees until there was a final board decision.
And you're okay with the representation of counsels, if you will, both Mr. Carpenter and by extension, Mr. Cameron, that there's no need for us to provide any form of special notice or anything, for example, to the veteran in this case, in this matter. Is the Secretary comfortable with that?
The Secretary provided a notice of intervener in June 2018 in this case, and I have not received a response from the veteran.
Well, I don't mean to speak for myself. I think what Judge Allen is saying, is there a danger to the, and I think I understood from Mr. Carpenter, there is no danger of a clawback or the secretary going after some payment made already to the veteran.
Your Honor,
as a result of this case pending.
Your Honor, I'm not sure if the full amount of past due benefits was paid to the veteran or if the 20% was withheld in this case. Your Honor, I couldn't.
What are we supposed to do about that?
Well,
that's an important. Well, look, it's not important to me because I think I understand how I would rule in this case, but I can't speak for the court.
Your Honor, our position would be.
Is that something we ought to worry about? That there's a veteran out there who thinks he's been paid 100%, but he's really only going to be able to keep 80% if we rule in favor of the lawyers here?
I can't speak to what would happen in that matter. Certainly, I do not believe that the attorney should be paid. But if the veteran hypothetically were paid the full past due benefits and this court were to rule in appellant's favor, I'm not sure if an overpayment would be created or not.
Is there a policy that the secretary has with regard to situations like this?
Typically, I'm unaware of a policy. I know in other cases where the full amount was paid and 20% wasn't withheld, an overpayment was created. So that is a possibility.
Yeah, so just so you know, I agree this might not matter, particularly because you gave notice to the veteran, and I'm assuming the secretary gave notice of what the state of the world was, meaning either we've paid you 80, we're holding 20, or we've paid you 100, but just so no, we've got this fight going on in court. I mean, and if the veteran doesn't intervene, my key is getting notice. But just so you know, in other cases, and particularly a case called Casey, for example, the Secretary's counsel took the position that its understanding of law from the Federal Circuit was that it was required to pay the lawyer, and then if it had made a mistake, seek reimbursement from.
Yes, Your Honor. I was actually the representative.
I thought you were.
When an overpayment is created, when 100% of the fees are remitted to the veteran and the 20% wasn't taken out, it would create an overpayment and did in that case.
So here then, if the court ruled against or in favor of Mr. Cameron, and the VA had paid 100% to the veteran, if you follow what seems to be what the secretary does, it would take the position that we can't pay, understandably, we can't pay twice for something we could only pay once. So if you've already paid 100% to Mr. Cameron, to Mr. Bolden, and now you have to pay 20% to Mr. Cameron, you got to look for the 20% overage somewhere.
Certainly, and
okay.
Yes, and there would be issues of waiver and things
right.
Like that. I do think the attorney fee eligibility determination noted that the full amount would be submitted to the veteran, but again, I'm not sure what.
But it is in the record before, I should know this and I apologize, it is in the record before the court, the notice that the secretary provided to the veteran?
It's on the court's docket, I believe under Rule 3.
Okay, great. Oh, okay, well then now I feel better that I didn't find it because I was thinking of the record. So if it's on our docket, hide it in plain sight for me. There we go, okay.
And before turning to the merits, the secretary submits that the court should stay this matter pending the resolution of Carpenter Chartered in the interest of judicial efficiency.
What is the status of that at the Federal Circuit?
Your Honor, I believe the secretary's response is now due January 27th. So the litigation is advancing in that matter, and
isn't this sort of though? And I am not as deeply wedded into that, but I have looked at the Federal Circuit's or the briefing, at least the opening briefing. It strikes me this is like a flea on the tail of the dog at the Federal Circuit.
Your Honor, it is certainly one of several arguments presented in that matter, but as appellant stated in his response in opposition to the motion to stay, the same issue is presented in that matter. So although it is one of many, certainly the same legal questions before the federal.
Well, why should we stay anything? It's here. It's right for decision here. Why should we wait? If we get it wrong, the Federal Circuit will reverse us. Why should we stay anything just because it's pending somewhere else?
Your Honor, the court can choose, of course, not to
stay. We have a veteran here. He may die, right?
I am not sure of the veteran's.
Well, of course, we're not sure. But if the veteran dies, the case is finished. So why should we delay anything?
Well, the Federal Circuit ruling on the same legal question may be dispositive and it would be binding.
Yeah, well, it may not come for another year, another week. Who knows?
There would be.
I'm asking for the Secretary's position on the naked assertion that I'm making. Case is here. It's ripe for decision. Why shouldn't we decide it, notwithstanding what else is pending somewhere else?
Because we believe that the Federal Circuit decision on the same legal question could result in more litigation for this court, a second opinion perhaps if this decision were to conflict with the
Federal Circuit. Well, the Federal Circuit can be appealed to the Supreme Court, couldn't it?
It could, Your Honor.
Then we should wait for that?
I believe that the stay would be in the interest of judicial efficiency, but certainly this court may proceed and hold that section 14.636. If there are no further questions, the Secretary submits that the court should affirm this matter.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Carpenter, proceed.
Your Honor, the fee decision in this case is at page 4674 through 4677. And it does not indicate one way or the other whether the fees were withheld. It's my recollection that they were withheld. I will confirm with my client whether they will and file a notice.
You believe they have been withheld?
That was my understanding from Mr. Cameron.
So where are they? They're sitting on a ledger book somewhere at the Secretary's office.
Correct.
Okay. And so that if, sorry,
no.
If we were to rule against you, it's a bookkeeping matter, or
the funds.
The funds will be sent to the veteran.
Yes, Your Honor.
I understand.
Now, in regards to the question about notice, yes, there was notice provided, but that notice was simply that Mr. Bolden had the right to intervene. There was no indication about the potential consequences of this case, as you had lined out in what you had thought apparently was the text that. Should be in a notice.
But you've now cleared that up for us. If we rule in your favor, the monies have already been set aside.
Well, I will verify that, Your Honor. That's my recollection, and I will confirm that they have been withheld.
Well, I'm not holding you to anything but your good faith statement to the court. We understand. Proceed.
I'd just like to clarify the distinction between this Cameron case and the Cameron case decided by this court at 26 FedApp 109. In that Cameron case, there were two separate claim streams. In this case, there is only one claim stream. The difference is that the ruling in Cameron was that the second claim stream did not become effective because all that Mr. Cameron did in the second claim stream was to put the VA on notice that they should adjudicate a pending claim. They adjudicated that pending claim and found that there was entitlement to benefits. The Federal Circuit, excuse me, when it affirmed, read the statute to turn on the question that no services were provided in that second claim stream. No question about the services provided in the first claim stream, and that was not at issue in the second. I'm going to figure out how to differentiate between these Cameron cases, in the 2014 Cameron case. So I just wanted to clarify that issue. I believe quite candidly that Judge Allen characterized the appellant's position much better than the appellant's counsel did, and therefore I don't have any further comments to make on the substance of the matter. Unless there are any further questions from the court, I don't see a reason to retract.
Thank you very much. We'll consider the case. We'll reserve opinion, and we will come down and greet counsel.